considered as security-related ones. Iran's membership in the SEO is also in tandem with the Chinese policy of Asian people to uphold Asian security. Given its political clout in the region, Iran can play a central role in dealing with the issue of Afghanistan, a security concern for the SEO members. The Shanghai Cooperation Organization works to strengthen security and trade cooperation in Eurasia. Iran's membership in the group would demonstrate the country's good relations with China, Russia, and Central Asia, at a time when the West is hell-bent on rendering Iran an isolated country. For example, in August, Tehran and Moscow announced they would start using their own currencies for trade rather than the dollar. Iran and Uzbekistan also signed several cooperation agreements ahead of the SEO summit. And back in June, Iran and Kazakhstan unveiled a new railway network in a further effort to boost trade. For years, the West has been tightening the screw on Tehran to abandon its peaceful nuclear program. But with the country's recent membership in the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, the West's stick seems even less threatening than before. Iran can now cooperate more intensely with China, Russia, and the rest of the SEO members, such as India and Pakistan, to build immunity against Western sanctions and pressures, a game changer the West didn't like to face in dealing with Iran. علي حبه جنة وسيم النار والجنة وسي المصطفى حقا إمام الناس والجنة. The Gate of Knowledge. Exegesis and interpretations of the supremely eloquent sermons, letters, and sayings of the Commander of the Faithful, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him.
You're listening to the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitani rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Alhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen. Wassalatu wassalamu ala Sayyidina Muhammad wa ala Ahli Baytihi at-Tayyibin at-Tahirin. Dear listeners to IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. I welcome you all to this episode of The Gate of Knowledge, where we are discussing about the topic of the Charter of Islamic Governance based on the teachings of Imam Ali alayhi salam in Nahjul Balagha. We are currently focusing on the 30th sermon, where Imam Ali alayhi salam explains about, you know, analyzes and interprets this event that happened regarding the murder of Uthman, the reasons why this happened. And Imam Ali alayhi salam was saying that there is a general principle, basically, that whenever there are dictators and there is a group of there's a group that is dictated and there's a group that, you know, is oppressed, and a group tries to uprise against that oppression, they are jazi', means they are complaining, they are unhappy, they are taking steps, they are showing their their unhappiness and their uneasiness, and their they are deterred by this and they are showing it, then know that there is a certain principle that is applied. And and then Imam says that in this situation, the third caliph was a musta'athir. That means he exercised certain forms of dictatorship. And we gave some examples of that. He was not ready to listen to the criticisms. He was not ready to listen to some of the complaints that very, very powerful and sincere companions of the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam had. Apart from Imam Ali, of course, Imam Ali alayhi salam, someone can say, okay, maybe they would not want to agree with him for whatever reasons. Then let us look at the other companions. And I mentioned the other companions at that time. Even the wife of the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam, even she, at the end of the day, she also spoke against him. And all of these things were happening at that time. And when this group of people came against Uthman, and of course they were not ready, and then there was a group that unfortunately, or whatever, for whatever reasons, they went and, you know, they killed Uthman. And what happened in history happened.
You are listening to the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio, a program that presents a detailed commentary of Peak of Eloquence from the Master of the Faithful, Imam Ali, peace be upon him.
Now, we give examples of some levels of dictatorship that Uthman had in his time. And we say that these are there. If you refer to Sharh of Nahjul Balagha, or the interpretation of Nahjul Balagha by Ibn Abi al-Hadid, under the discussion of this sermon, you will see that there is a lot of discussion, and he brings so many quotations and citations regarding the type of actions of a dictatorial nature that were performed by the third caliph. And these are, of course, intellectual discussions. Whoever wants can refer to them. If you refer to Tariq Tabari, you'll also see some of those events, as I mentioned in the previous session. So it was a situation where that the third caliph was not allowing people to think out of the box. He was not allowing them to express their unhappiness and their criticisms against some things that were validly wrong. I mean, and unfortunately, that didn't happen. But yet Imam Ali alayhi salam, he says that yes, Uthman, the third caliph, he did some actions of dictatorship that were not good at all. But on the other hand, وَجَزِعْتُمْ فَأَسَأْتُمُ الْجَزَعْ. But then you people also, I mean, those group of people who were expressing their unhappiness, they're expressing their criticisms, they also, unfortunately, they did it in the worst way. Yes, when there is an oppressor and there is an oppressed, when there is a dictator and there is a dictated, then there is a forcer and there are people who are forced and who are now expressing their unhappiness and their anger. When they do that, they're supposed to do it in the right way. But this group did it in the wrong way. In other words, here Imam Ali alayhi salam is kind of expressing his criticism in an allegorical way with regards to those people who killed Uthman. In his opinion, it seems that taking the law in your own hands and killing Uthman without a process of arbitration was not correct.
Stay tuned to the IRIB English Radio.
Now, we come to this situation where we see that Imam Ali alayhi salam says, وَجَزِعْتُمْ فَأَسَأْتُمُ الْجَزَعْ. That you people, you spoke against, you expressed your anger, but you did it in the worst way. You are not supposed to kill Uthman. If really you had some complaints, and yes, your complaints were valid, then your job was to come and take this whole case to judgment. You could take it to Imam Ali alayhi salam. If you accept him as a caliph, then you could tell him to be the arbitrator, to be the judge, to come and explain and take the decision in a proper way, forming the processes of judgment. And yes, Imam Ali alayhi salam was ready for that. If the people were ready to take Imam Ali alayhi salam as a judge in this particular issue, Imam Ali alayhi salam would definitely have accepted, and he would have taken a decision based on justice. Now, when Imam Ali alayhi salam says this, he's not saying that the complaints of these people were wrong. Their complaints were correct. The way they expressed their complaint, the way they, you know, took the law in their own hands, and they went and ended up murdering Uthman, that was something wrong. They were supposed to come and, complain in a legal way to Imam Ali alayhi salam. They come to Imam Ali alayhi salam after doing the work. They killed Uthman. Now they're coming to Imam Ali alayhi salam. Now look, that is a lesson for us today, that sometimes we might have true and correct concerns, but we don't take the right steps in expressing those concerns. And when we don't take those right steps, we end up creating harm on the path of truth. Now look, because of this thing that they did, the people against Imam Ali alayhi salam got a very good excuse to come and create havoc in the society. But if they would have taken the right processes, and if Imam Ali alayhi salam would have taken judgment in the right way, you know, he would have followed those principles, which was that he would have definitely done if the people would have referred to him. And he even tried to advise them not to take such harsh steps quickly without the right form of judgment. Unfortunately, they didn't do. If they would have done it, then you could have seen such a, an easy going process that would, you know, be of good for both of the sides and for the whole community at large. Let us pray to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala that we learn from these events of history and are able to apply in our lives. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom, on the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio.
قال النبي محمد من كنت مولاه هذا علي سيد فاز من ولاه هو بالكتاب مسدد والنور معناه باب العلوم ومرشد هو آيات الله من ناداه أو لبه حين دعاه نال مناه هو في الشدائد منجد والفضل يمناه هو في المحاسن أحمد والوحي رباه.
Join us in this journey, IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EM.
Sheikh Baqir Sharif Al-Qarashi decides to compile.
So we can consider Sayyid Hadi Khosrow Shahi.
Shahid Muhammad Baqir al-Sadr.
He was born in Qadhimiyya.
The first and the most important thing that we can learn from Allama Tabatabai is his great effort.
In this regard, I should like to say that one of the great benefits of the late Ayatollah Sayyid Mahmud Shahruddin was.
When we look at the works of late Rawzati, we see.
There is a famous sentence from Mirza Khalil Qamarani that he says in Farsi, "Tuhid kalame baraye kalame tuhid."
Be more familiar with outstanding Shia figures in the teacher.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is The Teacher, an introduction into the lives and works of the most outstanding Shia dignitaries, scholars, ulama, and authors all across the world of Islam. For today's discussion, I have two very special guest speakers, one from the Islamic House of Qom, Sheikh Mahdavi, and another from the University of Qom, Dr. Muhammad Reza Fakhr Rouhani. Sheikh Mahdavi, assalamu alaikum. Welcome to your show.
Alaykum as-salam wa rahmatullah.
And Dr. Fakhr, assalamu alaykum, brother.
Assalamu alaykum, thank you.
Today we want to talk about the late Allama Muhammad Baqir Mahmudi, the author of Nahjul Sa'ada fi Mustadrak al-Nahjul Balagha. This is his magnum opus. We will talk, inshallah, more about this book. But first, let's take a look at his biography and life. Sheikh Mahdavi, give us some information about the personal and scholar life of this outstanding man, that is Allama Muhammad Baqir Mahmudi.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحیم علامه شیخ محمد باقر محمودی is born in 1302 according to solar calendar and passed away 1385. He is regarded as one of the outstanding faqih, muhaddis, متکلم, historian, مورخ and catechologist of Shias who mainly studied in Najaf. Actually, his ancestors are regarded from the great ulama, not his father, because in his biography, when he is asked that, do you know the exact time of your birthday, he is saying that because my father was a farmer and he didn't know how to write and how to learn, he didn't register my birthday exactly.
Okay.
So only my grandfather and his ancestors are regarded from the great ulama that were giving the religious services in their area. When he was 19 years old, he decided to leave his hometown, which is Alamarvdash, one of the cities of the province of Shiraz.
Yes.
He left Alamarvdash to Najaf, but he has a very nice story, which is regarded as the beginning of the difficulties and problems that he took in his religious journey up until he becomes a great Allama. And he also narrates that I really suffered during this long journey.
That's right.
And as an example, he is saying that the time I wanted to leave Alamarvdash to Najaf, the only way to go there, I had to go to Bushehr. So from there up to Bushehr, it's almost 300 kilometers.
Okay.
He's saying that I was forced to walk because I didn't have any money, because that time people would take a horse and donkeys to move these from one place to another place. So I walked up until the Bushehr, and from Bushehr, I took a ship. I stayed in one island, Khark, and from Khark, I went to Abadan.
And we know that the weather situation over there is really hot.
Yes, yes.
You know,
so he's saying that when I arrived in Najaf, we had a very far relative over there, and they didn't accept to have me among themselves. Why? Because they asked, do you have any money with you that you want to stay in Najaf?
Okay.
I said, no, I don't have any money with me. The only thing that I had was one abba or garments that I gave it to someone to take me from Karbala up to here.
Oh.
So a very difficult situation. He actually is narrating the suffering and difficulties that he started his journey to stay in Najaf, the way that one of those relative gathering accepted, okay, no matter, you can stay here, I will give some portion of the money that you might be in need to go and buy the book, to go and buy the clothes, I mean the these specific wearing of talabe. So finally, Amir al-Mu'minin, after so many testers, accepts him to be next to Amir al-Mu'minin and stays there. And he starts his scholarly life till he arrives to the point that we see that many of the great ulama, like Allama Shahid Mutahhari, when he comes across with one of his books, like Nahju al-Sa'da, is saying that this is the best collection of the sayings of Amir al-Mu'mineen.
Yes.
And
yes.
Nahju al-Sa'da is only one of his works. That, inshallah, that's in our right. discussion today, we are going to cover his works and his yes. achievements, inshallah.
Okay, and the sincerity and the endeavor that they, and the dedication that they had, really, we can say, make the path towards salvation, both in this world and the other world, especially, as you said, helped them a lot in compiling such outstanding works like Nahju al-Sa'da, which is really outstanding. You know, after Nahju al-Balagha, I think the best one is Nahju al-Sa'da, as the collection of the sayings and all, we can say, the statements of Imam Ali alayhi salam, which can be referred to and is really authentic. Okay, Dr. Fakhwani, let's be a little bit concerned with his scholarly life. What information can you give us?
Yes. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim wa bin Nasta'in. First of all, it must be indicated that as dear friend and colleague, Mr. Mahdawi, has pointed out, the late Allama Mahmoudi was a really self-motivated scholar in yes. his academic career. And it's really very very hard to imagine such a dedicated person in a remote, at a remote village to try to, I mean, to leave his hometown or home region
yes.
and to go to Najaf rather on foot, okay? At the same time, when Allama Mahmoudi reached the Najaf, it was certainly the golden period of the Najaf Hawza and Najaf Seminary. This is because great ulama were available over there.
Yes.
And compared with other cities where, for example, researchers might not be able to avail themselves of very fine books and nice libraries, everything was expected to be ready, I mean, readily at hand in Najaf.
That's
this
right.
is one. And another one is that at that time, Allama Mahmoudi came in contact, in personal contact, with great luminaries of the Najaf Seminary, like the late Grand Ayatollah Sayyid Mohsen Tabatabai Hakim, Ayatollah Khoi, Ayatollah Shahrudi, and others.
That's right.
And they left a long-lasting impression on his mind and on his academic career. In this regard, I should like to say that he devoted his life, first of all, his academic life, to selecting, I mean, classic, historical classics of the lives of the infallibles, mainly those written by Sunnis, like, for example, Tabaqat ibn Sa'd and others, for example. He decided to produce critical editions.
Yes.
I mean, annotated and critical editions of those works.
This is what we call it, Mustadrak, is it?
Mustadrak, yes.
Okay.
And in this regard, it must be indicated that, I mean, parenthetically, I should like to say that I've read many of his books,
okay.
and I've consulted many of the books that he edited and he published.
That's right.
Not in Iran, but elsewhere. For example, of Ibn Sa'd's Tabaqat, I mean, which is a very, I mean, detailed biographical literature. I mean, he selected the chapters or the, I mean, sections devoted to Imam Ali alayhi salam, Imam al-Hassan, Imam al-Hussein, Imam al-Sajjad alayhi salam, and produced a very detailed exegetical and annotated edition of those texts. In some cases, he makes references to other sources, or in some cases, he comes to provide the correct form of certain expressions in the text.
That's all right.
Because as you know, okay. some spelling mistakes
yes.
or some typos
yes.
might create some misunderstanding for the later generations. But the late Ayatollah Allama Mahmoudi, I mean, he himself, when he was busy with publishing okay. some of his works in Lebanon, in Beirut,
yes.
I knew well that, because at that time I was living over there, I knew that he was very meticulous.
That's
so
right.
he wasn't such a person to give his book to a publisher and go home. Rather, he was such a person
That's
that
right.
every day, from morning up to the evening,
okay.
he was busy with, I mean, together with the publisher and a typesetter, he was always, I mean, busy with, I mean, creating the best exegetical types of the text that he was going to reproduce.
That's all right.
Not mechanical reproduction, yes. But academic, I mean, appraisal of the text.
That's all right. And I think this was his interest because it gets to establishing a center for the revival of Islamic culture, yes, in Islamic Republic of Iran, isn't it? And yes, over there, all his interests, it's called, yes, the interests, you know, were actualized. So many compilations and so many works. He has also so many works about Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam,
yes,
as you said, correction, revision, and re-edition of so many outstanding works, which are really great, and he was truly a scholar. But still, he is known by his book, Nahjus Sa'ada fi Mustadak al-Nahjul Balagha. What is this book, and what was his research methodology in this book, Sheikh Madhavi?
Okay, regarding Nahjus Sa'ada, I think our listeners and audience, if they get some sort of information about the number of the khutbah, speeches, and also messages, letters, and the short sayings of Imam Ali, which are collected in the Nahjul Balagha that they are familiar with, and make a comparison with Nahjus Sa'ada, they might get the value and the hard working that Allama Sheikh Muhammad Baqir Mahmoudi has put forth in order to compile such a precious compilation.
Yes.
So when you go to this normal Nahjul Balagha that we are familiar with, we see the number of the speeches or khutab is 241, which in Nahjul Sa'ada, based on the vast research that he did, he succeeded to compile 500 khutbah.
Okay.
It means twice Nahjul Balagha. Mm-hmm. The number of the khutbah which are compiled in his collection is almost twice this normal or ordinary book that we are familiar with. And the number of the letters or messages of Amir al-Mu'mineen to his governors or enemies, friends, and companions, in Nahjul Balagha, the number of the letters reaches 79, but in Nahjul Sa'ada, we have something around 300, almost four times,
yes,
Nahjul Balagha.
Yes.
And also we see that we have the category of du'as.
Uh-huh, supplications.
The category of supplication. And the time he was alive, he was living in this world, the chapter of the short sayings of Amir al-Mu'mineen has not published yet.
Yes.
But I'm aware because I have some sort of engagement with the center that you mentioned,
yes,
which is located in Qom, the Center for the Reviving of the
Islamic culture.
Yes, Islamic culture.
Yes.
Majma'e Ihya'e Farhangi Islami.
Yes.
Right now, it's under the process. They are trying to,
okay, very,
yes,
nice,
have a very good compilation with a good certification and giving very good references from which book this short saying of Amir,
okay,
al-Mu'mineen has been quoted, and they are dropping and removing all repeating sayings in order to have a very clear and neat job for the listeners.
Very good.
So when we look at such a huge work being done by one author, it shows us the amount of the efforts that he put forth. He himself is saying that I was really close to Allama Amini to the point that I was given this permission to stay in his library, mm-hmm, 24 hours. And I would say anybody, when it reaches the time that you want to close the doors,
okay,
close the door, don't come in. I don't need anything, no water, no bread, nothing. I prefer to stay here. And he says that above 1,000 book I read in order to compile such a precious collection. And we know, and at that time they didn't have access to the computer the way that we are doing, so we easily Google part of the saying and then we may find or may not. Sometimes we see that something that they have achieved,
that's right,
is not even comparable to what we may achieve through all these sophisticated gadgets, computers, and whatsoever,
right,
we have. So it's really, really outstanding work that he did. Also, my short addition, maybe I'm going to end my talk with this, that for audience and listeners, they're familiar with the great personality of Ayatollah al-Uzma, Safiye Gulpayegani. Recently,
yes,
1 year ago,
yes,
he passed away. He says that the works of Ayatollah Muhammad Baqir Mahmoudi must be introduced to everyone,
mm-hmm,
without having any hesitation.
That's right.
So it shows that how his works are really informative,
yes,
free from flaws or mistakes.
That's right.
He says such a words with this certainty that his works all must be introduced to everyone.
That's right. And we know that for doing research on the statements and the sayings and the aphorisms of Imam Ali alayhi salam, he did not only refer to the Shiite references, but all the denominations inside Islam. And this makes his work and the personality of Imam Ali alayhi salam, we can say, the content more interesting for the whole Muslim communities all across the world. Okay, Dr. Fakhwani, Nahjus Sa'ada fi Mustadrak Nahjul Balagha, brother, how did you find this book? Is this book at all translated into English language or not?
No, I don't think so.
Okay.
Unfortunately, while our colleague and friend Sheikh Mahdavi was talking, I was thinking about a process or a trend of introducing this rich Shia legacy to the world. And yes, the only pathway must be translation into English, because
right,
when you translate something from any language into English, you help it get internationalized.
That's
and
right,
universalized.
Okay.
Okay. However, in this regard, I should like to say that apart from the whole book, I mean, which hasn't been put into English, which hasn't been translated into English, unfortunately, so far as I know, this book must be categorized among the thousands of other valuable books and
yes,
sources that hasn't received even a synopsis in English, let alone
yes,
any, for example, brief translation or, for example, an overview.
And Nahjus Sa'ada fi Mustadrak Nahjul Balagha is the most comprehensive book
yes,
regarding, we can say, the statements of Imam Ali alayhi salam.
Yes, in this regard, it must okay, be indicated that, first of all, if not a complete translation, at least a descriptive
yes,
bibliographical introduction
yes, yes, yes,
or a detailed and graphic synopsis or summary of the book
mm-hmm,
should be produced in English
yes,
so that it would be accessible to others. Because when you translate something, I mean, when you translate an introduction to a book from any local language into English, at least you show this pathway to researchers from other cultures or other,
right,
I mean, languages, okay, or other communities, okay, that, for example, this valuable item is available, okay, and this is a short introduction to it in English. But
okay,
so long as, I mean, this first or this initial step hasn't been taken, okay, we cannot expect other people to come and identify it. In this regard, I should like to say that there is a center in Qom, Bunyad Nahjul Balagha Foundation in Qom.
Yes.
I visited a couple of times. Unfortunately, they are not that active in the realm of English. They mainly focus on Persian and sometimes on Arabic texts. So it must be indicated that, such books and such sources still await good and introductory translations
That's
into
right,
English.
Thank you very much, Dr. Fakhwani and Sheikh Mahdavi. The late Allama Muhammad Baqir Mahmoudi passed away on Farvardin 27, 1385, according to the solar calendar. His body was taken into the holy shrine of Lady Fatima to Masuma in the holy city of Qom, and he was buried over there. And we really missed one of the most outstanding revivers of the Shiite legacy, and Imam Ali alayhi salam, the author of Nahjus Sa'ada fi Mustadrak Nahjul Balagha, which is really a magnum opus. And I really invite our dear listeners, brothers and sisters, all across the world of Islam to refer to this book if they want to be more familiar with the character and universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam through his own words. Thank you very much, Sheikh Mahdavi and Dr. Fakhwani.
Welcome.
And thank you much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of the program, The Teacher. For more information and to download for free our previous episodes, visit our website at parstoday.com/en/call of Islam page. To another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanallah.
Bazaar.
Almost everything around us is either made of plastic or has some plastic component. The use of plastic products in our daily lives is so widespread that many of our regular activities require a wide range of plastic accessories and products. Plastic is everywhere, from our homes to offices, businesses, and health centers. It is also used to make aeroplane parts, cars, trains, and so much more. Plastic is one of the most widely used materials due to its versatile features, which have boosted economies across the globe.
Well, hello there, and welcome to another edition of Bazaar, the program that analyzes profits, markets, industries, and all sorts of things that connect us nationally and internationally. This week, we are going to take a look at Iran's plastic production. We wanted to see how this market is doing and check out some major players in this sector. We will also peek into some of its contributions to the national economy. Enough said. Let's walk through today's Bazaar. To become more familiar with plastic products and their production, we visited Parham Plast Aria. This company has been around for many years and is a major contender in the plastic products market. It makes hundreds of plastic-based products for a variety of uses. Some products are household plastic items such as baskets, dishes, utensils, and even larger things like chairs and tables. All things considered, this company provides some of the highest quality products found in the market. This is mainly because of its choice of raw material, which is rigorously tested for quality in its control labs. Moreover, raw materials such as polymers and additives are abundant inside the country. So, it doesn't have to look far for its feedstock. One of the advantages this company has is it controls the whole production and distribution process from design to sales.
In terms of household plastic products, there's always a thirst for newer and more stylish products coming from consumers. So companies must stay on their toes and create new molds each year to offer products that excite customers. However, making new molds is not always easy, and it can be an expensive process. That's why some companies choose to import molds instead, while others develop their own in R&D departments.
This company's research and development division is at the center of all productions. It is where new products are created. It is also tasked with keeping the company up to date in several fields, including production, consumer trends, and other domestic demands. Plus, it is no surprise that this unit is also where national and international standards for safety and durability are applied. It might be interesting to know that this company was a pioneer in setting standards through some of its products nationwide. Each year, this company evaluates the market to release the most recent product designs, giving it a competitive edge over other brands. Its massive production facilities can produce thousands of tons of products each year. As part of its future vision, this company is already expanding its facilities by launching a new production line. Once this new unit is up and running, it will add some 8,000 tons to its annual production. It also hopes to create its very own high-quality molds in the near future. This firm has overcome significant challenges over the years to enjoy its many achievements. Presently, this company is operating under its potential production capacity, and its ultimate goal is to use its full potential along the lines of exports.
Now, plastic is known as a group of synthetic or semi-synthetic materials created through the polymerization process. So, one of the most prominent ingredients in this mix is polymers, which are a derivative of petrochemical products that come from processing oil. It's not surprising that Iran has an ever-expanding polymer industry, given its large oil reserves.
We looked at some figures from the National Plastic and Polymer Industries Association. Data showed that the polymer industry gets most of its feedstock from domestic petrochemical complexes. Plus, there are some 8,000 production units that make plastic products nationwide. These units have a total capacity to produce roughly 13 million tons annually. Some $3.3 billion worth of polymer products were exported last year. That's according to the National Plastic and Polymer Industries Association. Furthermore, it says these exports registered a 23% increase compared to the year before. The association also says exports in this sector make up roughly 7% of the country's non-oil exports. Iran's oil and petrochemical industries are subject to US-imposed sanctions. Still, the wide variety of their products and high international demand has kept the market floating. On a broader scale, switching attention to added value products to boost non-oil exports has been a transformative move for Iranian industries. Through this, the country has tapped into its advanced domestic capabilities and diversified its economy toward a knowledge-based one. Household appliances are universal and an integral part of our modern daily life. Nearly all households have some sort of appliance meant to bring ease and comfort to everyday domestic tasks. Additionally, these items assist us in preserving and preparing food, cleaning our clothes, and overall helping us stay healthy. In general, the near 100% penetration of appliances in homes shows how crucial they are for our way of life and just how abundantly available these items are.
This week, we will journey through Iran's massive home appliance industry. We wanted to see how this sector has developed over the years and check out some major players in this manufacturing arena.
To become more familiar with this sector, we decided to visit Steel Alborz Industries. It was established 30 years ago and has since become a well-known household brand. This company began its work by producing steel sinks. Later, it added to its product basket and began manufacturing stoves, ovens, stovetop ventilation systems, and taps, among other kitchen attachments. With two factories in Shiraz and one in the capital, Tehran, its production facilities can make hundreds of thousands of units annually in over 200 different models. One of these factories is solely dedicated to various molds needed to create its stylishly modern products. Early on in its manufacturing journey, this company used to import steel stencil sheets from Europe. But after becoming a subsidiary of the second largest producer of galvanized steel sheets, it began purchasing most of its raw material domestically. The company uses the latest technology to manufacture its products. Its production lines are equipped with cutting-edge automated assembly systems managed by experienced staff. Nonetheless important is the use of high-quality raw materials and strong sustainable designs are two key components in guaranteeing the long life of these kitchen appliances.
Here is a short word on the machines used in manufacturing home appliances in Iran. Many production machines and automated systems, such as steel laser cutters, are domestically produced. Of course, that's not to say all of them are locally made. Some still need to be imported, but it is noteworthy just how much of this equipment is already available in domestic markets.
Research and development and quality control are critical activities of this manufacturing company. The R&D department is responsible for developing new products as well as monitoring the market and customers' needs. Its quality control division is built into its production facilities. Here, items are frequently checked and tested with the latest technologies to ensure manufacturing uniformity. As you might know, this also guarantees that each item is made exactly the same, which increases the quality of the final product. The R&D and quality control departments are also responsible for implementing national and international standards, which led the way for its exports. Currently, this company not only distributes its products nationwide, but also sends its items to neighboring and Eurasian markets. This company largely attributes its success to its highly experienced and specialized staff, who are in charge of various production processes. On the whole, it has created numerous job opportunities directly and indirectly. Plus, it has dozens of representative agencies across the country. Like many in the home appliance industry, this company has faced many obstacles throughout the years. But its trump card has been its unique approach to solving these challenges. For example, the US-imposed sanctions were one that this company transformed into a domestic opportunity.
Now, Iran domestically produces a lot of raw materials needed in this sector, which spares local manufacturers from spending millions on imports. What's more, domestically supplying raw materials to the home appliance industry has helped it blossom. But you don't have to take my word for it. Here's an overview of the sector and its productions, including some insight into raw materials produced in Iran.
Iran is the 10th largest steel producer in the world, just behind Brazil. However, China is the undisputed producer with nearly 100 million tons of monthly output. That's just to give you an idea of how large the country's steel sector is. It's undoubtedly important, as the country's mammoth industry feeds numerous down-the-line sectors, including home appliance manufacturing. The World Steel Association's figures show that major Iranian steel mills produced nearly 30 million tons of crude steel and products last year. It might be interesting to know that over 30% of total productions are typically exported, generating millions in foreign revenue. But that's not the only industry that supplies raw materials to the home appliance sector. Petrochemical products, such as polymers, which are used to make plastic, also contribute to the production of home appliances. Iran's Home Appliances Manufacturers Union says some 15 million household appliances were produced in the country last year. That's far beyond the original production target of 12 million units set by the government. Meanwhile, Iran exports many of these products to neighboring regions, including Asia and Africa. Last year, the total value of exports was over $300 million, according to Iran's Trade Promotion Organization. All things considered, there is a lot to look forward to regarding Iran's expanding home appliance sector.
Okay, I shall now step aside for several minutes and let my good friend and colleague guide you on an educational adventure out on the field. Take it away.
Most of you have probably thought about biking to work, or biking to most places for that matter, instead of driving. You get a little workout done in your probably sedentary lifestyle, you help the environment, you don't pay for fuel during a global energy crisis, and well, frankly, you look cool. But you never actually got to doing it, or you did it a couple times and realized that it's not for you. Maybe it was too difficult. Maybe you were burned out halfway through and had to take a taxi for the rest of the way, or that you showed up too sweaty for work. If you're still, however, interested in the idea, just not so much the problems, electric bikes are just the thing for you. And just why do I say that? Well, let's imagine you are biking to work and you find yourself burned out, or you get a bad cramp and you can't pedal the bike the rest of the way. So here are your options. You take a taxi and leave the bike, which is not really an option. You go back home hoping you were less than halfway to your destination, otherwise it will be even more difficult to do that. Or wait a good while till your energy level comes back up and miss work a little bit. None of these are elegant options, really. There is one, though. You have an electric bike, so you either don't even pedal at all for the rest of the way and just use the throttle on your electric bike, or you have the bike assist your pedaling so it's not as difficult and draining. You still get a workout done, but you're not drained completely afterwards. When he said 80% of the electronic kits are made in-house, it meant that pretty much the only thing that isn't being made here is the battery test kits and the LCDs they install on the bike handles that show you your current speed, wattage used by the motor, battery level, etc. And even that has a custom software. The 500, 750, and 1000 watt motors are made in-house and are installed in the way that you are seeing right now. Regular bikes from different brands and manufacturers are taken into the facilities and then they are prepped to have everything installed on them. There are lots of types for bikes, and for each bike with its purpose, they might use a different battery capacity and motor. For example, they use a 1000 watt motor and 64 cell battery on their biggest and baddest fat bike meant for rough off-road terrain, and a 500 watt motor and a 52 cell battery for their urban bikes that don't benefit too much from the extra horsepower. I mean, it's not actually horsepower, but you know what I mean. The process that goes behind turning mundane regular bikes that are great for a workout to one that is not as good for a workout, but is a lot more convenient and a lot more capable of transporting you from one place to another. So first they need to cut some holes into the chassis, precision holes into these oftentimes aluminum chassis, to make room for the connections between the controller as well as the throttle on the handle and the battery pack. So once they have installed, now it's time for the electric motor, which is going to be installed on the rim. So they take the rim off, they disassemble all of the spokes on the rim, they reinstall it on the electric motor, but there's a crucial step here. They need to make sure that the screws of the spokes that are connected to the rim as well as the electric motor are completely balanced so that the rim doesn't skew to one side or the other. So they spin it to make sure it doesn't touch two screws on both sides. If it does touch it and there's friction, they need to re-tighten or re-loosen some of the screws to make sure it's completely balanced. And now, which is designed for the 500 watt electric motor, this is the entire system with the battery pack installed and the controller also attached, as well as the throttle. But there's also another cool thing about this particular display and this whole system, but I'll reserve that for just a few minutes after we talk to one of the people behind this project to give us a little bit more information.
As an engineer and environmental enthusiast, I've always looked for a product to simultaneously save the health of the people and save the environment. And that's why I started a company called EVTech to manufacture electric bicycles in Iran. Currently, we are the largest e-bike manufacturer in Iran, and our bikes are tailor-made to Iranian trains. And people can use them here in our mountainous cities like Tehran easily. Our bikes are ranging from fat bikes, mountain bikes, and city bikes, and have different motors with different output powers. So you can choose from our products based on your need and your applications. At the core, we are a company that mainly manufacture power electronic components of e-bikes and electric motorcycles. We are manufacturing power electronics chargers, power electronic e-bike controllers, and also design brushless DC motors that have been used in our products and electric motors that manufactured by other companies. We also manufacture our battery packs and use very, very sophisticated battery management systems to ensure that our batteries are working in their ideal conditions and are safe to use in everyday basis.
is the last bit of information that I said I'd be talking about before. So the bike has its regular set of gears. You got the back gears and the front gears. But then there is this plate and with this number that shows a assistive gear, let's call it. So when the number is on zero, when you pedal for like one round, it doesn't assist you at all. But as the number goes up, it assists you more and more. So if you pedal the same amount and the number is on like three, it pushes you a lot further than if this number was set to zero. This is great for those times when you feel like you're really burned out and you can't pedal that much, especially when you're in an upward slope. So you increase this number, you get more assistance from the electric motor to push yourself forward a lot more. Now it's time for me to take it for a quick little spin. So this throttle is the difference between enjoying bike riding and not so much enjoying it and looking at it as a chore and just a workout. I have been like one of the people that I mentioned at the beginning of the program, the type that wants to bike to more places but doesn't do it because I find myself burned out too quickly when I'm going up a slope. With this, I can enjoy the flat surfaces and the downward slopes in biking, which are a lot more enjoyable than the upward slopes, and just skip the difficult slopes. So I'm seriously considering getting one of these electric bikes myself. And with that, we have come to the end of the program. Until next week.
What an awesome report, as always. Many thanks. Now, let's finish off the program with a look at some news and trends in this sector. As we mentioned, there is a trend of adding value to items to increase their uses and profits. And Iran's nanotech industry is paving the way for a variety of added value products, particularly in the plastics industry.
Iran's Nanotechnology Innovation Council estimates that roughly 800 kinds of Iranian-made nanotech products are in the domestic market. One of these is the development of biodegradable plastic bags through nanotech research. Iran's advanced products in this sector are sent to nearly 50 countries worldwide. Last year, these exports generated over $700 million. Iran is among the top five countries in nanoscience production and scientific achievements in this field.
Plastics are a vital component in Iran's medical device production as well. And this sector is seriously booming with new products each year that help save people's lives.
Last year, Iran produced thousands of medical devices, which it exported to 56 countries worldwide. Iran generally holds a 1% share of the global medical equipment market. Moreover, the Ministry of Health says Iran's stake is worth over $500 billion. That's 200 times more than its value in 2018, demonstrating how fast this sector is growing.
Speaking of plastic, one cannot overlook the harmful impact its waste has on the environment. It's terrible. And plastic bags have the most amount of waste, both domestically and worldwide.
Iran produces some 490 tons of plastic waste each day, and one-third of this is from plastic bags. While Iran recycles a lot of its plastic, controlling this waste is still an uphill battle considering production and consumer practices. Therefore, Iran's Environmental Protection Agency has embarked on detailing more regulations for reducing the use of plastic bags. The draft regulations include replacing plastic bags with biodegradable versions and creating production standards for environmentally compatible plastics. Most importantly,